Our second part is going to be, now that we've kind of seen what spirituality is, and by the way, I encourage you, as someone had mentioned, to read Father Ron Rollheiser. I think, look at his first name is Ronald.
He's in our paper.
Very, very, very good on this. Excellent. And he really gets into the whole idea of what spirituality is, as we have been seeing. Now let's talk, let's use those particular ideas and get into, all right, specifically, how does that dovetail with and connect with what we're doing as Carmelites? Very interesting that there's a theme that our modern scholars have found, Father Kieran in the Discalced Carmelite tradition family, and Father John Welch in our O'Carm Carmelite tradition, both working together very assiduously in Washington and really developing and putting out some marvelous, marvelous studies and looks and views into Carmelite spirituality and tradition. They have come up with some very fascinating things, I think, that kind of clarifies. And one of the things that has been found, it's amazing how many times the Song of Songs has been used by Carmelite mystics and writers. The Song of Songs. And you're familiar with, I think, the theme of that. It's a very passionate love song that we find in the Old Testament. Yearning for the loved one. John of the Cross expresses it in very kind of sensual terms, in the sense of he is wounded. And we have heard that term used in love, huh? Wounded by the lover, and that lover has walked away. So it's kind of like this incredible idea of it's a wonderful fantasy, I suppose, is to be sound asleep and then someone very wonderful kisses you and disappears. And you say, who did that? And you know that this person is absolutely wonderful. And you want to meet this person. You want to be with this person. And so the journey starts. You're looking for this person who has, in John's words, wounded your heart. So in a sense, he's talking about the same thing we saw this morning, where we were looking at this idea that we're restless. And as Augustine said, O Lord, we are restless until we rest in you. We saw that the heart, and we are people with dis-ease. We're not at ease. And we're always yearning. And nothing seems to satisfy us because, as our Carmelites would say, and as any knowledgeable a spiritual writer would say, because we're not focused on the one thing. God himself is the only person, the only being who will satisfy our longing. Not that other people are bad or illegitimate or somehow we're off on a tangent. No, some can be. But most of the time, the loves that we focus on, that are legitimate loves, are wonderful. And they are a taste of and a tool of, an instrument of God's love to bring us to him. Okay? We'll get into that a little bit. So the Song of Songs in the Old Testament, this image of being wounded by the lover, the unrequited love, and maybe some of you and some of us have experienced that, you know, where we really love someone and somehow we can't return it, or it's not returned, it's a very frustrating feeling. In a sense, that's what it is. Here is John saying, I have been wounded like a stag, and I'm looking for the one who wounded me. In this sense, it's love. And the search is there, looking for the one who has wounded my heart, who has so touched my heart. And it won't be satisfied until I find this person. Unrequited love. And this is the search. This is why our hearts are restless. So it's a beautiful image and has much to do with our Carmelite tradition and our Carmelite way, this wounded heart particular mode. Maybe just a little bit. Maybe just a little bit. The air is good, but it's blowing my notes away. The early Carmelites, we see as an example of, here were people who were, in John's concept too, but in a different way, here these hermits went to the Holy Land. They were already there. These, perhaps some were crusaders, we don't know. Certainly some were wandering hermits. They come out of Europe. And why did they, again, they're searching for this thing that will last. There was a thirst for them to be satisfied. And they looked upon Elijah as the person who had the secret. Somehow Elijah for them had found the secret. And had found God in the whisper of the wind. And boy, they wanted that. And so that's why basically they settled on Mount Carmel, this nameless group that settled on Mount Carmel. Even our leader, who is he? Good old Saint B. B. Whoever B is, see? We don't know who B is. Later on, we named him Brocard. Good, you did your homework well. But that was centuries later. We don't know who he is. We got embarrassed. He didn't know his name, so I gave him, hey, call him Brocard. Quit calling him B. You know, it's embarrassing not to know where you live. I mean, Francis, Franciscans, Dominic, Dominicans, Augustinians, Benedictines, Benedict, Carmelites, B. It's in our rule, brother B. That's it. Twice he's only met B. So very humble guy. But the thing is, and isn't it wonderful? And I tell our vocation prospects, this is wonderful because, see, if you got Francis, wonderful man, God knows. But the Franciscans have to live up to this very solid image and the writings of Francis. There's not a lot of legroom there. Benedict, same thing. And he wrote, ye Benedictines, whoop. They got to look to Benedict and whatever he said. So you can get a Franciscan to say, now Francis said, and Benedict said, but you can't do that with the Carmelites. We don't know what B said. We have no clue what he said. And the Patriarch of Jerusalem, Albert, who put together the rule, said, and these are a few guidelines to help you on your way, he said. And those who do more, God bless you. Wow. Well, that gives a lot of legroom, lots of legroom, which is wonderful for the Carmelite tradition and our vocation. So nothing is strange to the Carmelite vocation. You can do anything you want. And nothing is strange to the Carmelite tradition of prayer. Charismatic, contemplative, Lectio Divina, the Rosary, all kinds of prayer. All kinds of ways in which we can find the one thing in our life is possible. That gives us a wide range. That's the beauty, I think, of Carmel. The fact that there's not a lockstep type of process where we have a certain figure, God bless him, like a Francis, that we have to kind of live up to that exact standard. Wow. Ours is more, you know, that's why I think Carmelites are so independent. I mean, look at the two of us. Do you ever see two different characters in your life? Charles, what did you say about your humility yesterday or talking?
I was telling a prior, mischievously, trying to, he was very straight and for defending the faith and everything. So I told him, I said, I find humility to be very
See, that only a Carmelite could say that. And when I got on the virtue of humility, I said, which I share with Charles, I said, I am proud of my humility. It's, you know, it's one of my best virtues. Let me tell you about it. I'm proud of my humility. It's the only economy I could get away with that. I would tell people in vocations, I'll say, when you've met one Carmelite, you've met one Carmelite. We're a different breed of cat. You know, you meet everybody as individual. And I think that comes from Carmel. Carmel doesn't rip you down and start over. We're not the Marines, you know. We're not the Marines. Carmel says, we like who you are. God is not a junk dealer. God doesn't play with junk. He made you just the way you are, and you turned out fine. What we will do as Carmel, we will take the beauty that you are and that you have, and we'll do a little honing and a little chipping away as the potter, the great potter, and we're going to help you enhance who you are. That's the beauty of Carmel. God is not a junk dealer. Every one of you has within you spirituality that I said this morning. And how you want to focus your spirituality, the Carmelite rule says, go with it. Where are your talents? Where are your gifts? Go with it. And we'll help you along the way. Are you a good psychologist? Study psychology. Do you have a big mouth? Be a vocation director. Are you a wonderful pastoral minister? Go in. Go to South America. Retreat. Whatever. Huh? Use your talent. You are not junk. I'm not junk. Huh? Sometimes I eat it, but I'm not, you know. So this is the beauty of Carmel. It accepts you who you are. The beauty that you are. Some groups, which will go unnamed, don't accept. I've seen this in vocations. And I know this up and down and all around. Different orders, you know. They don't say, we accept who you are. They say, we basically don't like who you are. You need a lot of fixing over. So they put away the mallet and the little chip and they take a sledgehammer and go, boom! We'll start over, folks. You know, all due respect to the Marines. But when you've met one Marine, you've met them all. How are you, soldier? Fine, sir. How are you? Good. And what are you? Yes, sir. The Corps, sir. And they all get the white hats and the blue. I love them. The Marines are great, but I don't know one from the other. They all sound the same. They're all saying the same thing. Why? Because the Corps comes first. The Corps, see? The Corps comes first, not the person. For the Marines, they got a different job that works. You have to think of the Corps. Carmelites are not that way, and neither should religious groups be that way. God is not a junk dealer. You have within yourselves tremendous gifts and talents that you have to discover, rediscover, and move on with them and use them to the best of your ability. Mother Teresa. I'm sure she was a great teacher when she was in the teaching order in Eastern Europe. I'm sure she was a great teacher. But by gosh, she wasn't somehow tuned into what her real talents were, what her real desire was, until she confronted India. Boom! And boy, did that change her life. Wow. If she never went to India and taught in her little school in Eastern Europe, you never would have heard of Mother Teresa at all. She would not have been living up to the great gifts that she possessed. Definition of God's will can be used in any facet. And you say, what's God's will for me? And that is so, you say, oh my Lord, that is so deep, that is so philosophical. What is God's will? I mean, I don't want to answer that because I have no idea. Yes, you can answer it. Very simple. You know what God's will for you is? God's will for you and for me is following my heart's deepest desire. Think about that. How does God speak? He speaks to your heart. God's will for you and for me, for everyone in this room, for everyone, is following your heart's deepest desire. Take Mother Teresa. She was following a desire to teach. Beautiful. When she confronted India, what did she find? Her heart's deepest desire. The poor. And once she hooked onto that, she was then following God's will for her. Can't go wrong. We have to find out what God's will for us is. What does your heart say? Once you do that, you're connecting God's will with your talents. You're on the way. And that brought the clarity, brought the strength, brought the force that this little lady had that shook the world. She simply followed her heart's deepest desire. I remember a vocation prospect came and we talked. Oh yes, I want to be a priest, Father. I want to be a priest. And Carmelites, I've read all about the Carmelites. Good. Well, we'll talk some more. And I gave him some literature and got on my email and zapped him some links and stuff like this. And we're all going. And then he went, oh, great. And he was all enthused. Then about, all of a sudden, the email started to peter off. And then 6 months went by. Not a word. Well, finally, I was in the area. He was up in the Bay Area. And I met with him. And I said, let's go out for lunch. You know, if you get some time. Oh, sure. Okay. And didn't seem, I don't know. There's something different about him. So we sat down for lunch. To make a long story longer, told me, he says, it was kind of this way. Father, I apologize. I met a girl. Okay. And her name is Margaret. You know, whatever. And then, I like her, so I've been dating her. And that's why you haven't heard from me, so I apologize. And, you know, I really... Deep down, keyword, deep down, he said, you know, I think I want to raise a family. I apologize. Well, I heard 8 apologies, and then I said to him, why are you apologizing for following God's will? What is your heart's deepest desire? He said, raise a family. I said, guess what? That's God's will for you. You want to raise a family? You are meant to be married. That's so don't apologize for following your heart's deepest desire. You know, Carmelites 0, marriage 1. You know, okay, that day ended with that team won. The marriage team won. But he won. He won and God won because why? He's following his heart's deepest desire. Vocationally, that's where it has to be. Can't follow mommy's idea, her deepest idea. I've seen that too. It's mommy's deep desire. Oh, you make a wonderful priest, you know, Sonny. You think so? Yes, yes. And so the kid enters the seminary. You can tell by the look on his face, it's not his deepest desire. Mommy's deepest desire. And it was always, that's been the history of vocations. Huh? You said, your desire, or your mother's desire, or your father's desire, you know. So, very key to understanding our spirituality and where we can direct all that energy that we have. If we're not following our heart's deepest desire, we're going to be in dysfunctional spirituality as Carmelites. The Carmelite tradition attempts to name the hunger, give words to the desire, and express the journey's end in God. Carmel has always wanted the same thing and will walk with anyone we meet along the way. We cannot satisfy their hunger, but we can help them find words for it and know where it points. We can do it, and we have done it in our art, in our poetry, in our writings, our counseling, and our teaching, and preaching, and listening, and praying together, and understanding. Really, it's coming into what we talked about this morning, huh? That fire in the belly. The Carmelite spirituality is to recognize that people have a fire in the belly and help them, and along with ourselves, of course, to know that it is God that is the final quencher of the thirst, and to use the beauty and the talents that they are and work towards that goal. What can they do? What is their heart's deepest desire? Knowing God's will, praying about that, seeing my talents, and then go for it. Elijah. That's why, again, he's pictured on the mountain. He's pictured brooding and praying. And once he's focusing, he's trying to find out his heart's deepest desire. And once he finds that out, and for him it was, if you had to name it, what was his heart's deepest desire? First of all, union with his God and the whisper of the wind, which he found. Secondly, I do not like what the poor people of my nation are undergoing under the royalty and under the lords of the land. I will go down and kick butt. And he did. So he focused that energy and went down. That was his talent. And he knew it. He's good with the sword. People knew it. And that's where he was most effective. Teresa was good with the poor. I think a beautiful example. How many of you saw the movie Romero? About Archbishop Romero? And here's another, now here's another example, I think, of a man, a wonderful man who will be a saint, I hope, someday, who was had achieved the ultimate in priesthood. He was a bishop, right? Well, they elected him in Central America to fulfill this certain role in San Salvador, and there he is in El Salvador. And you know what? He was a nice guy, bookish man. And they kind of elected him anyway because, you know, we got a touchy political situation here. We don't want anybody rocking the boat. So put Romero in. He's a clerical librarian. He's a nice guy, likes ideas, and he's not going to rock the boat. So they put him in. Then he has priests coming to him, people coming to him, and they're kind of challenging him, you know, could you put your books down for a bit and listen to us? What's going on out on the street? And finally, he witnesses what's going on out on the street. And he's beginning now to listen to the words of the lay people and the priests about what's going on. And he's the bishop. He has a lot of clout down there. And there's one scene in the film where he's the Elijah figure, I think. There he is in his cassock, and he's walking down the path. That's all he's doing. And he's headed, and he's brooding, walking down the path, and it's all coming together. And all of a sudden, the walk down the path, which symbolically was a walk into the desert, was a walk to Mount Carmel, however you want to metaphorically put it, when he came back, he was a changed man. What had happened? He saw his heart's deepest desire. not just to be bishop, not just to pronounce wonderful theological arguments and doctrines, and he saw he needed, as bishop, and his heart went out to the people to try to correct what was going wrong with his people, done by the government, as Elijah did. From then on, he was a firebrand. Out there, much to the disruption and dislike of the government, and of course, you know the ending. In a Carmelite convent, he was gunned down. Gunned down at Mass. Yep. Carmelite convent. So he has a message for all of us. He found out, as Mother Teresa found out, what the heart's deepest desire is. So the Carmelite vocation is not running away from the world. It's embracing the world. Again, who is our spiritual founder? Elijah is our spiritual founder. Did he just stay on Mount Horeb and Carmel? No. He came down the mountain. All right? We Carmelites do not run away from the world. They embrace the world as it is. They do what they can within the context of their own specific talents and vocation. Teresa, Therese, another example. Who would ever think that somebody like Therese, tucked away in this convent in France, a young girl, spent very little time really in Carmel and dies of tuberculosis. Who would ever think that she would become the most popular saint in the 20th and even in the 21st century and become a doctor of the church? One cardinal suggested she be called Doctor of Hope. What was her talent? What was her talent? When she thought and she brooded, what can she do in this convent? Little things. The little flower. You know why she's called Little Flower? From a little nondescript passage that she recited, a metaphor that she used. She said, and rightfully so, she said, I'm not like the lilies, loud and beautiful and boisterous and big and tall. I'm not like a lily. I'm not like a rose with its complex beauty. She had I'm like ground cover. I'm a little flower. That's where it comes from. She said, but you need the little flowers in order to see the rose and the lily. So she said, I'm going to do my little thing. And so she found out within her context, as Mother Teresa could move out to India and rock the world, she could rock the convent with her love. She rocked the convent. And so the sisters who were messy, the sisters who were rattling their rosary beads, the sisters who, she actually had this mean sister thinking that she loved her. Of all things. She really loves. And even the sisters said, I think she loves me. Why is that? I'm such a mean person. And she said, that's God's will for me. My heart's deepest desire is to show love. I've got to do something with what I have. And what I have, I can show in this convent, even though it can be tough at times. Even though it can be tough, I'm going to try it. So she didn't walk away from her world. She embraced her world. She embraced her world. God's will for us is following our heart's deepest desire. Our language is prayer. That's how we talk to God. Our language is prayer. Words, spoken or unspoken. Words, formal, like the Our Father, or informal, coming from your heart. Either one are beautiful. When you send out a Hallmark birthday card, you're not being a phony. You say, I like this card. This is a beautiful card. I like the verses. That's not your verses. So what? You send it out. It's from your heart. You send it out. Formal prayers like that. Maybe not your words, but it's heartfelt. Therefore, they're good words. So formal or informal, that's our quiet or spoken. That's our language. What's God's language? How does God speak to you? I always get a little worried when people say, and some do, God spoke to me. And I go, really? Yeah. Did he have a deep voice or what? Well, yeah. Kind of like Charlton Heston. And he told me, and they go on with what God told them. That's spooky. So I always tell people, if you hear God speaking to you in resonant bass, tenor, voice, whatever, my son, my daughter, I said, see me after Mass, and I will send you to Father Charles, who is a shrink. And he will find out, use words. How does God speak to you? God speaks to you with significant events and people in your lives, positive and negative. That's how God speaks. You want to know what God is saying to you? Look at the significant events in your life and people who come into your life. That's God speaking to you. What is he saying to you? That's his language. Our language is prayer. His language, significant events, positive and negative, that impact your life. So the good people and the positive events that impact your life is God's language. They are there for your enhancement. It's like the vocation we take in. They're there for your enhancement. The negative things that impact your life, the deaths, the injuries, the divorce, the separations, all those and the innumerable, and we could all name them, what they are. The negative significant events and people that impact our lives are there for my growth. I grow from them. Why do you love love? Why do you love love? Why is love so potent and powerful in you? You know why? Because you've been rejected. That's why it's so powerful. If you were never rejected, if everybody loved you, love would be boring. Love would be so boring. Everybody loves you. You love love. You love to be loved because you have been rejected. That makes love important. That's why true love is so beautiful, because when a man chooses a woman or vice versa, they're saying to you, I don't want Marcia. I don't want Phyllis. I don't want Grinelda. I don't want Bertha. I want you, Elizabeth. That makes it beautiful. Where there's one choice, there's always renunciations included when there's a commitment. That's what makes love beautiful. Others have to be rejected. You are chosen. And that's why love feels so special. Someone says to you, I choose you above everyone else. Wow. But sometimes our choosing gets screwed up. And, of course, we have divorce. It really wasn't a good choice. It really was not thought out. It was for the wrong reason. Whatever. We're rejected. Ooh, ouch. Ah. That's why love is so precious. We know what it feels like. We know how wonderful it is and how painful it is without it. And so it becomes precious. and I grow from it. That's why we all have to go through those years and have gone through the years of rejections. How do you find the one love? You're rejected by others, or you're rejected. You're a nice guy, Bert, but you got bad breath, and I just can't take it. So we reject people. We reject people, or we don't have the capacity to love everyone. We don't. And some just say, you know, you're a wonderful person, but, okay? So love means I choose someone. Love is so powerful and so potent because of rejection. That's why it's so meaningful and powerful. So, the significant events and people in our lives that are positive, that love us, that support us, we're enhanced. The negative stuff that hits us, we wouldn't appreciate life if people didn't die. We wouldn't appreciate most things in life if bad things didn't happen to us. One, I recommend the wonderful book by Rabbi Kushner, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Notice how he phrases that? Not if bad things happen to good people, because they will. It's when bad things happen to good people. Wonderful book. God is not out there saying, I think I will take that Volvo that he's driving and run it into a semi on Route 5. I think I'll do that today. I'm in the mood. God doesn't do that. Life does that. How do you learn from it? How do you learn from it? We live in an imperfect world. It's a good world, but an imperfect world. The watch that I have will stop. I like my watch, but it's going to stop because it's made by an imperfect person called a watchmaker. It's going to stop. Can't do anything about it. Guess what? You and I are going to stop one way or the other, either on the highway or heart attack or old age or whatever. We're all going to stop. That's not God. That's life. Life takes you and me, not God. God steps in when life begins to slip away, because he knows what that's like. And he stands by you and says, okay, you've lived this certain life on earth. I'm with you, my son, my daughter. And then begins on the other side of our last breath. God is with us in our pain. And this really is the victory that the little flower found, that people, I think, who finally die, whether it was in the towers of 9/11, whether it was a heart attack or a car accident, they find the beauty of God beside them. A compassionate God who also went through his death. For our God's image, we do not have a whirling sun, a smiling Buddha. We have a man bloodied on a cross. I think that is trying to say something to us. Life is not easy, but if you remain faithful to the gospel, you will overcome it. There's a poem. I love it. And it takes place in a far-off land in Arabia. And his name is Abu Ben Adem. Abu Ben Adem, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace and saw within the moonlight in his room, making it rich like a lily in bloom, an angel writing in a book of gold. exceeding peace had made Ben-Adam bold. And to the presence in his room he said, "What writest thou?" And the vision raised its head, and with a look made of all sweet accord, answered, "The names of those who love the Lord I write." "And is mine one?" said Abu. "Nay, not so," replied the angel. Abu spoke more low, but cheerily still, and said, I pray thee then, write me as the one that loves his fellow men." The angel wrote and vanished. The next night, it came again with a great wakening light and showed the names whom love of God had blessed. And lo, Ben-Adam's name led all the rest.
I learned that poem at school, in high school.
The meaning is beautiful. You, what did God say? What did Christ himself say? That he made equal. What is the greatest law? Love your God and your neighbor as yourself. If we do that, using our talents, as Therese did in her small little French convent, or as our Mother Teresa could do for the whole world through India, what can you do? How, as a Carmelite, can you focus your spirituality given to you by Carmel? What can you do? And even with the pain that we all feel, that John of the Cross went through, that Teresa went through, that little Therese went through, do you realize that when she was speaking of everything is grace, and she was encouraging people, she was at her lowest ebb? When she received Eucharist, she said, "This is grace." You know what she said when they said, "You know, you can no longer have communion, you can't swallow." You know what she said? "This is grace. All things are grace," she said. Wow. To have that realization. All things are grace. She really meant it. So the pain that you and I experience in this life, and the ultimate pain, gives way to the kingdom if you and I are faithful to the compassionate gospel of Christ. Interesting how Christ describes the Last Judgment. I think it's curious that he does not ask you or me creedal things, doctrinal things. He knew that religion can also become an idol. That's why John of the Cross says, nada. Even other things, religious things, can become idols. They're all means to him. They're means to the end. So it's interesting that Christ kind of had this sense when he describes, his description of the Last Judgment is what? When I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was sick, you came to see me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When you have done these things, you are one of mine. Come into my kingdom. Mother Teresa saw that. In her own way, she said, boy. And those who have not, Lord, when did we see you? Hasta la bye-bye. Very interesting. So your prayer as Carmelites and my prayer as Carmelite, whatever we are, they are a means to an end. Your Carmelite vocation says, and the Christian vocation, but yours especially says, pray, brood on the scriptures, but don't let it sit there. We have to love. We got to get out there and do that. If you and I do that, on the other side of our last breath, we will find our God. No matter how much pain you and I have. What did Paul say at the end of his life? I have run the race. I have finished. And there is left for me a prize. What was the race that he ran? He lived out the compassionate gospel of Christ. I run the race. I follow Jesus and his compassionate gospel. There's a beautiful story that comes out of the Montreal Olympics. Maybe you remember it. It was a Japanese gymnast, Shun Yashimoto, perhaps, was his last name, but Shun, his first name. A very dramatic thing happened. He was a superb gymnast, and his great strength was on the rings. And during a floor exercise with his teammates, as the imperfect world will do, sweat built up, he slipped and broke a leg bone. He couldn't walk. They had to help him off the mats and out of the gym. Well, the next day was to compete. He was supposed to be a champ. Go for the gold. It's all over. They had given up on him, the coach, everybody. It's over. How tragic. It's life. The next day, guess who shows up with his teammates, limping badly, with bandages wrapped around that leg, still broken? Shun. People were amazed. The audience, the judges. They didn't disqualify him. The judge didn't, the coach didn't pull him. What? And his teammates did their thing on the horse and all the stuff. What's his greatest strength? What was his deepest desire? Rings. Didn't need to walk. And so his coach grabbed him, threw him on the rings, and he flew like a bird, twisting and turning in beautiful synchronicity. He was poetry in motion. Incredible. But he knew. The moment of absolute truth was coming up. The dismount from the rings. Minutes and then seconds away. And all he had to do was fall. It's over. And he's flying to the rings. And now minutes are down to seconds. And then, as the audience is watching, they all sensed what is going to happen at the great moment of truth. And he flew off the rings with triple somersault and landed with a thud on the mats, and people winced, expecting disaster. And they looked, and there was Shun, who stood there, and his face grimaced with tremendous pain, and he looked up, never wavered. And then he knew he had won the gold. And tears streaming down his face, he raised his arms in victory. He felt no more pain. He had won the prize. He had won the gold. Same with us. The reporters came to him afterwards and said, microphone shoved in his face, how did you do that? What was it like? He said, I can't describe to you the pain that shot through my leg and went right through my head. I can't describe it. But the minute I looked up, I knew I had won the gold, and there was no more pain. All of us will make that journey. All of us will make that journey. It will be, in one way or another, painful. But you and I will be victorious. As Shun realized his heart's deepest desire, as you realize your heart's deepest desire is the one God and living out his compassionate gospel to the best of your abilities, no matter what the pain, you and I can look up and say, with Christ, who also felt that pain that went from his feet right through his head, I've won. I have the gold. I have won the prize. That's our Carmelite vocation. Carmel can help you and I focus on desiring the one thing to the best of our abilities and talents that God has beautifully given you and I. Live those out in love and compassion, a la Mother Teresa, a la Saint Therese, both saints. And you too will find the prize. The image that you have here, so fortunate, of water. I read one last reflection, a little parable. The imagery is of ships, port, seashore. I am standing on the seashore, and suddenly a ship at my side spreads her white sails in the morning breeze. Starts out for the blue ocean. She is an object of beauty and strength, the sailing ship. And I stand and watch her at the shore in awe, until at length she is only a ribbon of white cloud, just above where the sea and the sky mingle with each other, her sails, speck of cloud. Then someone at my side says, breaking the silence, she's gone. Gone where? Gone from my sight. That's all. She is just as large and mast and hull and spar now as she was when she left my side. She is just as able to carry her load of living freight to the port of her destination. Her diminished size now disappeared is in me, not in her. Her sails are full. And just at that moment when someone had said, "There, she's gone," there are other voices taking up the glad shout, "There she comes." There she comes to the port of her destination. And that, my friends, is dying. There is no death. You have wonderful things within yourself. Carmel can help you find those wonderful things within yourself. You can now live that out. Let Carmel free you to live that out, following your heart's deepest desire in the compassionate gospel of Christ, and see you on the other side.